I just love seeing you all come in like this.
He's talking about the new refiners joining the Severed Patreon page. Just $5 a month and no cranial drill required. Go to patreon.com/severedpod.
Okay, you're all set.
Severed, the ultimate severance podcast.
Welcome back, refiners. Let's keep this thing going like a good old-fashioned MDE. This is Severed, the Ultimate Severance Podcast. I'm your host, Alan S. Welcome to part two of our Severed Origins Breakdown of The Matrix. The popular 1999 movie is one of those things Dan Erickson has mentioned that influenced him during the creation of Severance. As always, refiners, mortifying spoilers for The Matrix are ahead. Ready? Let's get that file reopened, shall we? Last time, we were standing outside the door of the hotel room where Morpheus is waiting. Since we're talking about one of the most feared and wanted men in the world, it's no surprise the hotel is abandoned and in a bad part of town, and it's pouring rain at night. These scenes are being shot in the historic Sydney General Post Office, or GPO, building. It is located in Martin Place, Sydney, New South Wales, Australia. Construction of the GPO began in 1866 and stretched over two stages for 25 years. It is the largest sandstone structure in Australia and a stunning example of the Victorian Italian Renaissance style of architecture. At the time of the production of The Matrix, the GPO was being renovated as a hotel in preparation for the 2000 Olympics. At the time, it was referred to as the Sydney Westin. As of 2019, the Sydney GPO became home to the luxury five-star Fullerton Hotel. Trinity has some advice before Neo meets the great man.
Be honest. He knows more than you can imagine.
She opens the door to reveal a fantastic character entrance. We cut to Lawrence Fishburne as Morpheus standing in front of a full-length floor-to-ceiling window. He's dressed in a black full-length leather duster cinched at the waist with a belt. As soon as the door opens, lightning strikes. Morpheus turns and...
At last.
Dang, you have got one great character entrance. Morpheus is being played by American actor Lawrence Fishburne. Born in Augusta, Georgia in 1961, Fishburne was truly born to perform. He never considered any other career path. At the age of 12, he landed a three-season recurring role on daytime soap One Life to Live. Fishburne was concerned about the long shoot cycle for The Matrix. He'd had a bad experience with a director running over on shoot days. At the age of 14, Fishburne struck off into the Philippines with Francis Ford Coppola for the weirdly ill-fated Apocalypse Now shoot. The 2 years he spent in the jungle with Coppola and Brando would affect Fishburne profoundly. It almost ended his acting career. He would not perform for 18 months after finally returning home. The young Fishburne had impressed Coppola, who would have him back for feature roles in movies like Rumblefish, The Cotton Club, and Gardens of Stone. Fishburne had his greatest career successes and truly became a star in the 1990s. He started the decade with a lead role in Boys in the Hood, then an Oscar nomination for his portrayal of Ike Turner in What's Love Got to Do with It. He capped the decade with his creation here of Morpheus. He would reprise the role for the back-to-back sequels. Although he was not the first choice for Morpheus, at least they didn't cycle through as many potential names as some of the other roles. Gary Oldman, Samuel Jackson, and Val Kilmer were all considered as the captain of the Nebuchadnezzar. No word as to whether it was actually offered to anyone other than Lawrence Fishburne. Check the Morpheus sunglasses. They're barely there. These are a Richard Walker creation marketed as the Morpheus from Blind Design. There is one tiny difference between what you see here and what you'll get when you buy the retail model. The retail version has a molded clip that you can squeeze over your nose to hold them in place. The clip is sleek and very functional, but it did not look cool on camera, especially in close-ups. With this no-clip version of the sunglasses, makeup people had to spirit glue them to the faces of Lawrence Fishburne and his stunt doubles. I couldn't find where Blind Design still exists, but you can still get these Morpheus clip-on sunglasses. Sunvoss sells a good-looking pair for about $35.
Welcome, Neo.
Morpheus introduces himself, just in case there's any doubt. Neo says he's honored to meet him.
No. The honor is mine.
Wow, the Big M is really buying the hype about the importance of this Neo fellow.
Please, come, sit.
Neo has a seat in one of the wingback chairs. Trinity leaves the room. Morpheus launches into his iconic red pill, blue pill speech. He tells Neo he must feel like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole.
You could say that.
I can see it in your eyes.
Morpheus asks Neo if he believes in fate. Neo says he does not. He doesn't like the idea of someone else being in control of his life. Morpheus agrees before having a seat.
Let me tell you why you're here.
Yes, please, let's do that.
You're here because you know something.
Not the explanation I was hoping for. As Mr. Fishburne launches into his very cool "something doesn't feel right about the world" monologue, a reminder about the Wachowskis and viewing this piece through a lens of transness.
What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad.
It's this feeling of not fitting in, of not being entirely connected to the world, that ultimately brought Neo to Morpheus. Morpheus asks if Neo knows what he's talking about.
The Matrix.
Okay, but what exactly is that? Morpheus says it's everywhere. It's everything. It's whatever you're doing or seeing all the time.
It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Now, that's very mystical, but what truth? Morpheus leans forward, intense.
That you are a slave, Neo.
He says Neo was born into bondage. I don't know, aside from the crappy software job, he doesn't look all that enslaved. Morpheus says Neo and everyone else was born into a prison we can't smell or taste or touch.
A prison for your mind.
Although he's just spent the last 3 minutes trying to tell us what the Matrix is, Morpheus then says,
unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is.
So maybe you'd better stop trying. Just show us already. Morpheus pops open a tiny box. It looks like he might be ready to propose to Neo.
You have to see it for yourself.
There you go. Awesome two-shot here. The wingback chairs are facing each other. Neo's on the right, Morpheus on the left. The whole thing is set off with some dramatic backlighting, and a huge fireplace is providing the backdrop. There's also a small table between them and a glass of water sitting on it. Morpheus dumps something out of the box into his hand.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back.
There's a close-up on Morpheus's hands. He opens the one to our right to reveal a blue liquid capsule.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe.
Check this close-up of Morpheus's face. His sunglasses have become perfect little mirrors. From our perspective, in his left lens is a reflection of Neo. But in the right lens, we not only see Neo, we can also see the blue pill sitting on Morpheus's palm. Cut to a close-up of his hands again. He opens the other to reveal a red pill. They look like liquicaps.
You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Cut back to another close-up of his face. We can now see the reflection of the red pill, but it's only in the left lens. The blue pill is still only in the right lens. Neo hesitates for a long moment, then starts to reach for the red pill.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
We cut to another awesome close-up of Morpheus's face. Here, his lenses are huge in the frame. Neo can be seen reaching for the red pill in the left lens. In the right lens, we don't see his hand reaching. He's just sitting there behind the blue pill. Neo takes the red pill and swallows it with a slug of water. There is thunder as he drinks.
Follow me.
Morpheus leads Neo into the next room of the suite.
Hey, Pac, are we online?
Almost.
Our driver from the Black Lincoln is now sitting behind a huge array of video monitors, keyboards, and unnamed electronics. Switch, who we also met in the car, and Trinity are here too. The guy who greets Morpheus as soon as he enters is someone we've heard, but not yet seen. This is Cypher. Stacks of unidentifiable equipment are scattered all over the room. Neo has a seat surrounded by coils and wiring. Sensing pads are placed on his skin. An ancient-looking rotary dial phone is somehow a part of all this. We can hear a line being opened. The phone is being dialed by a mechanical arm. The red pill was not just a welcome-to-the-club placebo. It actually has a function.
The pill you took is part of a trace program.
Morpheus then casually drops this line of mumbo-jumbo on Neo.
It's designed to disrupt your input-output carrier signal so we can pinpoint your location.
Big guy, his location appears to be right there in the chair in the same room where you're standing. Neo asks for all of us, what exactly does the input-output carrier thing mean? Joe Pantoliano as Cypher gets to deliver the smartass reply.
It means buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy, because Kansas is going bye-bye.
Fine, but this still doesn't explain what Morpheus is talking about. Neo seems a bit out of it. He swallows hard and looks to his right. His image is fractured in a broken mirror. Something seems to be happening to Neo, then something happens to the mirror. The glass appears to flow, almost like a liquid. The mirror reforms with a flat, unbroken image. Neo looks around at the others. Are they seeing this too? He reaches out with a finger. His fingertips seem to go into the glass as though it were liquid mercury. Uh-oh, the mirror's stretchy surface is now stuck to his fingers.
Have you ever had a dream, Neo, that you were so sure was real?
Neo is fascinated by this mirror. The surface seems to distort. It lets go of his finger and undulates like the surface of a drum.
What if you were unable to wake from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world?
Neo's fingers now seem to be coated with mirror. Morpheus either can't see what's going on or he doesn't care.
This can't be.
Neo's hand looks like the liquid metal of a Terminator.
Be what? Be real?
Well, maybe he can see what Neo is seeing. The liquid with the mirror surface starts to flow up Neo's arm. He says it's cold. He starts to look distressed, not sure what's happening to him. The rest of the crew is monitoring something. Apoc still doesn't have a lock. Morpheus pulls out an 8110 phone and snaps it open.
Tank, we're going to need a signal soon.
Neo is seriously wishing he'd never touched the mirror. The mercury or mirror or whatever it is has covered Neo's arm and crossed his chest. It's working its way up his neck to his face. Trinity seems to be monitoring Neo.
We got a fibrillation.
Morpheus tells Apoc he needs a location. Things are getting tense.
Targeting almost there.
Meanwhile, Neo is about to drown in liquid mirror.
He's going into arrest.
Apoc shouts, lock. He says he's got him.
Now, Tank, now.
Just as Morpheus tells Tank now, the mirror has overtaken Neo. It goes into his mouth, and we ride with it for quite a ways down his throat. We dissolve to the point of view of someone looking down their body. It's a naked body in liquid with large cables connected at several points to the skin. A hand pushes through a layer of clear gel. It's some kind of silicon-looking skin. A gooey, slick, wet-looking humanoid figure emerges from the pod. This, dear refiner, is actually Keanu Reeves, really and truly in a goo pod. They built one of these things on a Fox Sydney soundstage. They also really filled it with vaguely amniotic fluid-looking birth goo. Keanu was not the first one in the pod. A stuntman acted as a stand-in to test things out while the pod was being developed. It was not a good experience. The goo was cool. In one of the first full tests, they realized the goo leached body heat. The stuntman doing the test experienced hypothermia within 8 minutes of being placed in the goo. They got him out of there and warmed up, but from then on, the goo was heated before anybody was placed inside it. The scenes of Neo emerging from his battery compartment were the very last thing shot for the entire movie. In order to look truly authentic, Mr. Reeves lost another 15 pounds over what he'd already dropped due to the intense physical training. He wanted to look emaciated and very different from his in-matrix self. Then, the day these scenes were shot, he was entirely shaved. every visible hair on his body was removed. He said being entirely hairless was an interesting sociological experiment. The no hair, no eyebrow, no nothing look was so weird and creepy, he said most people could not maintain eye contact. This is Keanu Reeves with his movie star good looks, yet people had to look away during conversations because his hairlessness was so off-putting. The creepy, hairless, goo-covered Neo pulls what looks like an intubation tube out of his mouth. We aren't given all the details, but I was kind of thinking as batteries, humans would continue to receive oxygen via the blood. It's how we breathe in the womb. This intubation tube might indicate we are actually breathing air. It seems like getting oxygen through your blood would make it easier to exist in a pod filled with goo, but what do I know? Neo reaches back to touch an immense plug sticking out of the base of his skull. As he's feeling for it, he starts to really key in on his surroundings. He can see the world as it really is. Neo is in thrall and terror as he realizes he's looking at more pods filled with goo and people. There are huge towers of them, so tall you can't even see the ground. The goo-covered Neo takes it all in with a look of horror. He's not sure exactly what he's looking at, but it is not giving him good vibes. A flying drone arrives in front of Neo's pod. It looks Neo up and down, then grabs him roughly around the neck. As Neo is fighting with the arms of the drone, tentacles reach for the huge plug at the base of his skull. The drone grabs on and spins the plug several times until it comes unhooked from Neo's head. Neo passes out from the shock and is flushed out of the pod. In some discussion boards, the question has been asked, why would Morpheus send such a damaging drone to unhook Neo? I think the answer would be Morpheus didn't send it. By waking up, Neo is malfunctioning as a battery. Good batteries don't move. They don't stand up. They don't get out of their pods. The short circuit caused by the red pill, the malfunctioning mirror, shocked Neo to the point it made him wake up in the real world. A battery that wakes up is as useless to the AI as one that's dead. The drone looks him over and decides, this battery is malfunctioning. It needs to be disconnected and recycled. By unplugging the main connector to the skull, the rest of the plugs know this is no longer a viable battery. They spontaneously disconnect. The now dead and disconnected battery is flushed out of the pod to be recycled. Without any warning, Neo gets flushed. He goes sluicing down a tube through the tower where his pod had been located. Since they got a lock on his physical pod location, the Nebuchadnezzar was able to show up and retrieve Neo from the goo pool where he was dumped. He's pulled on board like it's some kind of helicopter rescue. He's lifted through an open door in the bottom of the ship. These shots of Neo sluicing through the tube, dropping into the goo, and being retrieved by the Neb were done on the very last day of primary shooting. The entire production shot for 25 weeks with a total of 118 days of actual shooting.
We've done it, Trinity. We found him.
I hope you're right.
I don't have to hope. I know it.
Cut to a gurney where Neo is laying. We are seeing now through Neo's eyes. Everything at first looks bright and blown out. The creepily hairless Neo asks if he's dead.
Far from it.
We then go into a montage of muscle regeneration. If you've never actually used a muscle since the moment you were born, it would make sense your muscles have atrophied. It looks like the process for waking up a patient formerly connected to the Matrix is a huge TENS machine. Neo is laying there letting the machine electrically stimulate and build his muscles.
Why am I, sir? You've never used them before.
Every sensory input Neo has ever received his entire life came through that big plug in the back of his head. This is the first time he's ever actually opened his eyes. If this were a Rocky movie, we'd be into a training montage right about here. Instead, we're watching the gang get Neo's body ready for the real world. It looks like basically more muscle stimulation and try to take out whatever plugs you can. We dissolve to Neo wearing rough clothes, lying on a bunk. He's no longer hooked up to the stimulators, but he does still have an IV bag hanging over him. Neo wakes up and immediately does something you should never do. He pulls the IV out of his arm. Ouch! In the real world, you notice there's very little attention paid to wardrobe and makeup. The idea is you wouldn't be worried about things like your haircut or stylish clothes if you're living in the primitive conditions of the Neb. In The Matrix, since style is just a selection in the loader program, the gang always looks good when they are in the construct. We're not given any time cues here other than Neo has grown in some respectable eyebrows and a short layer of hair. He's sitting on his bunk when he decides to investigate his data port. He slowly reaches around to the base of his skull. We get a close-up of his fingers discovering his hookup. I've always thought someone missed a trick here. Somebody should have been selling plastic or even metal reproductions of Neo's data port with double-sided tape on the back. I could see fans all over the country wearing their own Matrix data port to the theater. Just as Neo is about to touch the offending piece of hardware, there's a noise. A door is opening. Neo jumps as though he was caught doing something he shouldn't.
Morpheus, what's happened to me?
Yeah, coming to in a goo pod, sluicing through a sewer, then being plucked out of the goo by what might as well be a spaceship. It's gotta be a bit disorienting. If his current situation wasn't weird enough, Morpheus throws another wrench in the proverbial works. Neo wants to know, what is this place?
More important than what is when.
Oh, sure, let's completely upend whatever we thought we knew about time, too.
You believe it's the year 1999, when in fact it's closer to 2199.
The AI must have shut down Etsy and their needlepoint sampler calendars because Morpheus is a bit vague with the time details.
I can't tell you exactly what year it is, because we honestly don't know.
When you can't see the sun, it is hard to keep track of the day. Although Morpheus keeps trying to explain it, he again tells Neo there's no way it can be explained.
Come with me. See for yourself.
Now you're talking. Let's go check this out for ourselves. We cut to Morpheus and Neo heading up a gangplank. Morpheus is still dropping exposition. He becomes a massive exposition dump in just a few minutes. Right now, he's explaining the ship.
This is my ship, the Nebuchadnezzar. It's a hovercraft.
They arrive at the main deck. The Nebuchadnezzar, or Neb for short, is a bit rough. Lots of hanging cables and exposed wiring. In a documentary about the making of The Matrix, Keanu pointed out the red and blue wires running everywhere through the Neb. Yes, they are Severance chip colors, but as Neo points out, they are also the colors of veins and arteries. He said it was the intention of the Wachowskis and the Neb designers to make the ship feel like a bit of a biological crossover. It's a machine, but it has some attributes that make it feel alive, like pseudo-veins and arteries. The Neb is supposed to represent a melding of man and machine. The Neb is also messy. The Wachowskis thought their representation of spaceships like Star Trek's Enterprise just weren't accurate. If a group of people are living in this thing for years and years and it is constantly in service, it's gonna get messy. The Wachowskis preferred the raw, lived-in look of a ship like the Millennium Falcon or the Nostromo from Alien. This is why we get a lot of hanging wires and visible control structures. The Neb is even rusty and dilapidated in a lot of places because, as we're about to find out, this thing is old. There's a pan over the Neb's christening plaque. It was made in the good old US of A in the year 2069. Humans still had factories in the 2060s. According to the Matrix Wiki, the war and Operation Dark Storm, the codename for scorching the sky, wouldn't start until 2139. The Neb is a Mark III, whatever that means, and it looks like it was the 11th one built. If real time is somewhere around 2199, this would mean the Neb has been in service for about 130 years. This also means the Matrix has been active for less than 60 years. Although the Matrix requires hard lines in and out, it sounds like the Neb uses Wi-Fi to connect.
This is the core, where we broadcast our pirate signal and hack into the Matrix.
Morpheus introduces Neo to the gang. We already know Apoc, Switch, and Cypher. They were in the Matrix with Neo.
The ones you don't know? Tank and his big brother Dozer.
Tank, the smaller of the two with the big smile and curly hair, is being played by Marcus Chong. If you are of a certain age, I'm betting his last name just made you flash on the 70s comedy duo Cheech and Chong. Way to make those connections through a cloud of weed smoke. Marcus is the adopted son of Tommy Chong. His half-sister is Ray Dawn. Marcus was born in 1967 to Martin and Shelby Wyatt. Culturally, Marcus boasts African-American, Chinese, Native American, and British ancestry. Shelby would divorce Martin, then go on to marry Tommy Chong in 1975. He then adopted Marcus. Marcus started his acting career at age 12 with two episodes of Little House on the Prairie in 1978. He also appeared in two episodes of Roots, The Next Generations the same year. Marcus has 37 credits on his IMDb profile, but those stopped in 2013. Although he's been quiet for 10 years, Marcus doesn't seem to be out of the game entirely. He does list a part in an upcoming short currently in post-production. Dozer, the other brother, is being played by Anthony Ray Parker. Anthony is an actor originally from Saginaw, Michigan. He's about 9 years older than Marcus, born in May of 1958. Where Marcus was a child star, Anthony didn't come to acting until he was in his 30s. Anthony's career started on television in the early 1990s. He was a Minotaur on three episodes of the TV series Hercules: The Legendary Journeys in 1995. He even picked up a few video game voice jobs around this time. Anthony has worked pretty regularly since the mid-90s. He lists 56 total actor credits on his IMDb profile, and four of those are upcoming.
The little one behind you is Mouse.
Mouse is a mousy-looking thing. Mouse is being played by Sydney native Matt Duran. Matt was born in Sydney in 1976. He's another one who only considered acting as a life path. He had the lead role in the 1991 film Pirates Island at the age of 14. Matt stayed busy throughout his career, notching 46 IMDb appearances. Oddly, just this past April of 2023, Matt appeared in a comedy series called Auntie Donna's Coffee Cafe. His episode was We've Been Burgled, where he played the character Mouse. I have no idea if this appearance had any relationship to his Matrix Mouse. If you've seen Auntie Donna's or know what's going on with Matt's latest turn as Mouse, please drop me a note, severedpod@gmail.com. Morpheus puts his hands on Neo's shoulders. Interestingly, Lawrence Fishburne says he played the character of Morpheus as a father figure and a fairly stern alpha while he was in The Matrix. While in the real world, Mr. Fishburne said he played Morpheus with more of a caring, feminine, maternal side. This is not something he was directed to do. It's how he said he interpreted the character from the way it was written. This also reflects those themes of transness subtly laid into the script by the Wachowskis. They didn't even need to say anything. It just felt that way as written.
You wanted to know what the Matrix is, Neo?
Yeah, and all of us folks sitting here in the theater would like some info as well. Check the interior of the Neb in the long shot. It's a crazy mess of wiring and brackets. This is more visual imagery courtesy of Jeff Darrow. Jeff also envisioned the pod tower where Neo woke up. Except according to one of the producers, Jeff's initial drawings were way more frightening than what ultimately became the power tower of people. Trinity walks Neo over to the gynecological exam chair from hell. Neo has his seat and Trinity straps his feet into lockable stirrups. Morpheus says Neo should try to relax while he's laying Neo's head back on the chair's built-in headrest.
This will feel a little weird.
Cut to a close-up of the back of Neo's head. Just like with Severance, getting to work means jamming something deep into your brain. We can see the external cap of Neo's brain port. A metal spike, probably 8 inches long, goes into the center hole of Neo's port, all the way in. Not surprisingly, Neo reacts to having a metal rod jammed into his brain. His whole body heaves back, arching against the restraints. This is why they made such a big deal about strapping him in. As Neo is spasming in the chair, Morpheus casually reaches over to a touchscreen and hits load on a data source identified as supplemental drive. Cut back to Neo's screaming face, but it's not the same Neo. I mean, it's Keanu, but it's Matrix Keanu. He doesn't have his just-got-sprung-from-the-pod buzz cut, for one thing. He stops screaming to realize he is standing in a white, limitless void. In the distance, Morpheus appears dressed in a killer suit with a black shirt and contrasting tie. Neo must have needed some configuring for his first time. Otherwise, Morpheus had to jump right into that other chair almost instantly.
This is the construct. It's our loading program.
Morpheus says they can load anything from clothing to equipment to weapons to training sims, all right here.
Anything we need.
You might be wondering, where's the green tint? Well, there isn't one because we aren't in the Matrix just yet. This loader is a separate program being run right there on the Neb. It's being fed to their senses using the same format and data pathways as the Matrix, but only Neo and Morpheus are logged into this loader right now. Since it's protected, kind of like a network that's not on the internet, they don't have to worry about agents interfering with training. They have time to talk, practice, suit up. As Morpheus says,
anything we need.
Then, once they've equipped or trained themselves for the mission, the next step is to transfer into the Matrix. The camera does a sweeping pan around Morpheus to reveal the two wingback chairs we first saw in the hotel suite. The chairs are now sitting in the void, along with the small table that held Neo's water glass, and there's a 50s-era wood-paneled standard def TV sitting there. Morpheus convinces Neo he's in a computer program by pointing out how different he is from just a few seconds ago.
Your clothes are different, the plugs in your arms and head are gone. Your hair has changed.
Morpheus says this appearance, how he looks in the Matrix, is what's called residual self-image.
It is the mental projection of your digital self.
Neo runs his hand over one of the wingback chairs.
This isn't real.
Morpheus asks him, what is real? How do you define it?
If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, what you can taste and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain.
Hey there, Refiner. Does this sound familiar? This is the same mini philosophy seminar I hosted at the start of the show. Our understanding of the real world is always limited by our senses. This also seems like a good spot to discuss how these guys interact with the Matrix. I've always thought of the Matrix as the ultimate virtual reality experience. I've been fascinated with VR for quite a while now. I had the Oculus VR 1 with all the cords and wires running off it. Currently, VR technology provides really reliable and believable information to two senses, sight and sound. You get some feedback about movement through motion sensing hand controls, but it's nothing like real touch or true movement. The VR of the Matrix is totally and seamlessly immersive. It feeds a very believable signal to all five senses all the time. This is the VR tech Zuckerberg should really be working on, and if we knew the truth, he probably is. With the all-in-one back-of-the-head brain jack, your brain is being fed information about every sense constantly. It's so good you've believed it's real your entire life. But we aren't there just yet. Let's let Morpheus tell us all about it. They have a seat in the wingbacks in front of the old-style television. Straight on, all we can see is the full back of the set, and the back of this TV cabinet cracks me up. The logo, the name, it all looks like something a graphic artist might have created if they'd been given the assignment, create something that looks like it's from the 1950s. Amazingly, this set is all real. This is a Radiola model television. Across the top is the name of the new technology defining this groundbreaking set, Deep Image. The AWA logo between the words Deep and Image is the logo of the manufacturer, Amalgamated Wireless Australia. This set was manufactured by AWA starting in 1958. It was a 24-tube console model with a receiver tuned to pull in the VHS channels being used in Australia at the time. Cabinet finishes were available in walnut, maple, and mahogany. Morpheus picks up a large remote. This would indicate the specific AWA TV he's watching is probably the D65 introduced in 1965. It's still a Radiola, but it was the first AWA model to include a remote. The D65 also had two loudspeakers and a sharp-looking wooden case in your choice of finish. Get ready, Refiners. Morpheus is about to unload with a Matrix expo dump that buried a lot of folks in 1999. The picture on the TV is of random city shots. Morpheus tells us this is the 20th century in all its glory at the very end of the millennium.
It exists now only as part of a neural interactive simulation.
The simulation, the expansive virtual reality everyone is jacked into, is the thing we call the Matrix.
You've been living in a dream world, Neo.
Morpheus then changes channels, saying this is the world as it exists today. The screen resolves into a dark and destroyed city skyline. Not sure what city we're looking at, but there's nothing left. The cities on the surface are uninhabitable all over the globe. We go into the television. The sky is dark. There are streaks of lightning followed by deep, rumbling thunder. The camera tilts down, then flies to the base of a crater. The two wing-backed chairs are now sitting here, nestled into rock debris, a part of the hellscape we are seeing on TV.
Welcome to the desert of the real.
Morpheus then tells a thoroughly chilling story. It's become even more chilling considering the events of the last year or so. We are just now, in 2023, witnessing the development and widespread use of AI. Morpheus says we were enamored with our abilities as a society. Sound familiar? We had created AI and it was amazing, but then it got out of our control.
You mean artificial intelligence?
A singular consciousness that spawned an entire race of machines.
I'm shocked nobody thought this was a bad idea. Didn't anyone from this society watch the Terminator movies? For that matter, is anyone going back and having a second look at the Terminator movies right now, in real life? It feels like it wouldn't take much for ChatGPT to break bad and become Skynet. Morpheus glosses over a lot of war and drama. Much of it is covered in the Animatrix prequels, which are really worth checking out. The key takeaway, the AI machines which took over the planet ran on solar power. If they'd have powered up with nuclear, we probably wouldn't even be in this situation. Humans, who were in a pitched battle with the machines, decided if they could block out the sun, it would take away the machine's power source and wipe them out. As Morpheus puts it, the humans then scorched the sky in a desperation move dubbed Operation Dark Storm. This plan seemed as ill-advised as letting the AI run rampant in the first place. I figured they'd have tried for nuclear winter. A nuclear blast can eject enough debris into the atmosphere to blot out the sun. Over a large enough area, multiple nuclear explosions create what's called nuclear winter. It's effective at blocking out the sun, but you do have all those nuclear explosions to deal with. According to the Matrix Wiki, these future warriors did something very futuristic instead. They released nanites into the upper atmosphere to form a shield over the Earth. It had the same effect as nuclear winter without all of the explosions. It was a desperation move, but they thought it would stop the machines.
It was believed that they would be unable to survive without an energy source as abundant as the sun.
What these fearless warriors didn't seem to take into account was how the sun also keeps the planet and everything on it alive. Morpheus reflects that throughout human history, we have been dependent on machines to survive. This is true, and not just in the modern age. We've built an advanced humanity thanks to machines going all the way back to the wheel and the lever.
Fate, it seems, is not without a sense of irony.
Morpheus then makes a claim about the human body that doesn't appear to be accurate.
The human body generates more bioelectricity than a 120-volt battery and over 25,000 BTUs of body heat.
So the upshot of the story is the machines have turned us into their power source. He should have just said that. Since he made these specific claims about how much power we generate, he riled up the geeks. I probably spent more time on this than I should have, and I still don't have solid answers. There are a number of variables nobody addresses, like generation over time. Our output varies depending on our state of consciousness. When the human body is asleep, we produce less power. A sprinter produces a huge amount of electrical power versus somebody at rest. They are also mixing their units of measurement. Morpheus was quoting volts and BTUs. Most of the studies I saw attempting to correct him were quoting watts and BTUs. BTUs don't measure electrical energy. They measure heat. And humans definitely generate measurable heat. Unfortunately, the numbers Morpheus is quoting for heat sound way off. He said the human body produces over 25,000 BTUs. That's a lot of heat generation. It takes roughly a 75,000 BTU furnace to heat a 1,600 square foot home. By Morpheus reckoning, you could heat that home with the output of three humans? The thing is, he doesn't say if his measurement is instant, over an hour, a day, a week. I was able to find multiple sources saying we produce between 250 and 400 BTUs of heat energy. This is what we're putting out at any given time. We produce electricity primarily due to chemical ionization. Heat comes from our metabolism, breaking down fat and sugars to create energy. I think we're going to have to agree to disagree with Morpheus when it comes to the specifics of human power generation. I'm sure he has some source he's comfortable with for his numbers, but my sources aren't matching up. The thing we can all agree on, humans do produce both electrical and heat energy. The machines have decided to use us as their power source. Morpheus then gets into the nuts and bolts of running a human battery farm.
There are fields, endless fields, where human beings are no longer born. We are grown.
The CGI happening as he's talking is a squirming hellscape of machines tending to fields of glowing orange people pods. Sure, it's horrific, but they do look to be very efficient. Morpheus said he refused to believe it.
And then I saw the fields with my own eyes.
It's a closed, self-sustaining system. When a battery expires, the body is liquefied so it can then be fed intravenously to the other batteries. It's Soylent Green without the need for marketing. We then pan over a naked baby, connected to cables and lying in a pod. It's about to be covered with goo. The baby is moving slightly as we pan over it. People were very concerned about this baby when the movie debuted. What horrible stage parents would have consented to having their naked newborn wired up with big cables, then dunked in a pod of goo? Thankfully, no parents had to make that decision. This is actually a silicone doll. They shot it as a practical with the goo flowing into the pod around the doll, then gave the baby some movements using post-production CGI. Two questions have always kicked around in my brain when I hear this explanation of what's going on. First, how are they faking births? Morpheus said humans are being grown, not born. In the Matrix, people are still experiencing births, but no woman in the Matrix is actually getting pregnant. They're being given pregnancy signals and information to their brain, which simulates a pregnancy, but they are not actually growing a real person in their body. When the real baby is, I don't know, hatched, the machines are somehow connecting it up to the Matrix through what must be a simulated birthing process. This also calls into question, do the machines actually know how a human birth feels, or did they just make it really long and painful as a punishment? My other big question, why did they give the humans computers and the internet in the construct? Neo was hooked up inside the Matrix, yet he was able to access information about Morpheus and Trinity using the Matrix-created computer. He was able to do his very deep and mysterious searches, even though he was actually in a power pod operating from inside the construct. I've never understood why the creators of the Matrix would build computers into the scenario. As we've seen in The Right Hands, computers had the power to allow access to information which could even cause the downfall of the whole system. It might be because computers existed prior to 1999, and in order to correctly recreate the era, computers and the net had to be a part of it. Taking them away may have caused a revolt. Also, it is possible computers are safe and benign in almost all human hands. The explanation might be only an outlier with the skills of Neo would be able to use a computer within the Matrix the way he has. Maybe the machines were even blindsided by this person with the skills of someone like Neo. It's possible they had no idea the in-Matrix computers could be used against them the way Neo has been using them.
What is the Matrix? Control.
Neo looks more and more distressed as Morpheus continues to explain. Neo was living and working in a computer-operated dream world designed to keep him under its control.
In order to change a human being into this.
Hey, Coppertop. Morpheus holds up a very recognizable battery. It's definitely a Duracell, but Duracell must not have paid for product placement. Either that, or they didn't want their product associated with the evils of the Matrix. Morpheus very specifically shows us the back of the battery. No logos for Neo, but we still get what he's talking about.
No. I don't believe it.
Just like Morpheus, Neo also does not believe what he's being told even after all he's been through. He stood up in his pod and witnessed the immense stacks of humans firsthand. Standing here in this white void, watching the very cool, fully immersive multimedia production about the modern history of the Earth, I don't know why he doubts what he's being told. This is some pretty convincing evidence.
I didn't say it would be easy, Neo.
He reminds Neo he only said it would be the truth. This is it. You have been given the overview of the Matrix, Brilliant Refiner. You now know what it is, when it is, why it is, and basically how it works. So, do you get it? I might be an odd duck, but it made perfect sense to me the minute Morpheus explained it. Lawrence Fishburne said he never had a question about the big picture. It just made sense to him from the first moment he read it. Studio execs? Not so much. They did not get it and didn't think audiences would get it either. Many actors who were given the script were also a big nope because they could not wrap their heads around the central concept of the Matrix. Neo starts to panic. He's having an attack in the loader program.
Let me out!
There's a sudden cut to real-world Neo sitting in the ratty dentist chair. Dozer and Trinity are with him. Trinity is trying to calm him down. Neo jumps out of the chair, telling the crew to stay away from him.
I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
Come on, Neo. This seems like a pretty elaborate prank to pull on somebody. Neo is crumbling. He's on one knee, still saying he doesn't believe it.
It's gonna pop.
Neo drops to the floor and throws up through one of the floor grates. We cut to a close-up of Neo now sleeping, his eyes slowly open.
I can't go back, can I?
In a longer shot, Morpheus is sitting in the corner behind Neo's bunk. This pose and his delivery remind me so much of Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. I wonder how intentional this might have been. Morpheus tells Neo, no, he can't. But if he could, would he really want to?
I feel I owe you an apology.
Morpheus blames himself. They have a rule, never free a mind after a certain age. He doesn't say what age, but I'm betting you need to be in your teens to be able to accept such a major shift in what you've always believed to be reality.
The mind has trouble letting go.
Morpheus justifies what he did in Neo's case, saying he had to. Morpheus tells us the legend, the mystical backstory, the reason everyone believes a savior is coming.
When the Matrix was first built, there was a man born inside who had the ability to change whatever he wanted. To remake the Matrix as he saw fit.
This man is the one who freed the first humans from the Matrix. He also taught them the truth about their existence. Morpheus says as long as the Matrix exists, the human race cannot be free. I'm just not as outraged as Morpheus is about all this. Maybe I'd be more resistant if I knew it were happening to me, but I don't think so. I would argue, since the Earth has been rendered virtually uninhabitable due to the ongoing wars and nuclear winter, maybe staying plugged into the Matrix isn't such a bad idea. Morpheus sees it as enslavement. I see it as a more appealing option for existence, especially after seeing current conditions in the real world. Morpheus continues. This is the point where Neo comes into the story, or at least Morpheus thinks this is Neo's part of the story.
After he died, the Oracle prophesied his return, and that his coming would hail the destruction of the Matrix, end the war.
Morpheus believes this legend, and he's not alone in his search. He says he is just one of many who have dedicated their lives to finding this man, if he exists. Morpheus then says,
I believe that search is over.
Neo rolls over to look at him. Morpheus is saying this is Neo's destiny. He's the one who is not only supposed to control the Matrix, but also free humanity from its clutches. Being tapped as the savior of humanity has to be a bit overwhelming. Morpheus tells Neo to get some rest. He's going to need it.
For what?
Why, his training, of course. You can't expect the savior of the world to just pop right out of his power pod and start kicking butt. He needs some instruction. He needs to learn how to access this amazing control over the environment. Morpheus has faith. Neo, not so much. We cut to lights coming on throughout the ship. Neo is sitting in his sleep area. Tank opens the door and asks him if he slept. Neo says no.
Well, tonight, I guarantee it.
This is the second person warning Neo about the physical stresses coming his way. Tank steps into the room and shakes Neo's hand. He tells Neo he will be his operator, but doesn't explain what that means. Neo notices Tank's arms and hands.
You don't have any holes?
Nope. Me and my brother Dozer were both 100% pure, old-fashioned, homegrown human, born free right here in the real world.
Tank and Dozer's mother could provide us with the details of a real-world childbirth, but we don't get to meet her. Tank then says something cryptic.
Genuine child of Zion.
Neo's never heard of it. Tank says if the war was over tomorrow,
Zion's where the party would be.
This real-world underground Zion is something new to us, too, but we do know about a very famous Zion in The Matrix. Zion is a place name used in the Hebrew Bible. It is most often seen as a synonym for Jerusalem. At one point, Zion was probably the name of a specific hill in Jerusalem, but now it stands for the land of Israel as a whole. Zion might also be called the Promised Land. In the teachings of the Latter-day Saints, Zion is used to connote a peaceful, ideal society. The concept of Zion is also referenced in Islamic tradition. Tank doesn't know about these other Zions. He tells Neo, this city of Zion is the last human city.
The only place we have left.
Neo asks where it is. Tank is vague. He says it exists deep under the Earth's crust. Without the sun, there's no reason to remain on the Earth's surface. Zion was established underground to be closer to the Earth's mantle, a natural heat source. Tank's ready to get to the day's activities.
I gotta tell you, I'm fairly excited to see what you're capable of, if Morpheus is right, no.
Neo looks up, a bit concerned. This pressure to be the savior is getting stronger. Tank's a believer. He thinks Neo has a shot at being the one. He's ready to get to work.
We got a lot to do. We gotta get to it.
Cut to Tank saddling up in front of the monitors watching The Matrix. He's flipping through mini-discs looking at titles. He wants to skip the general operation programs.
That's Major Barnes. Shit.
Tank has what he calls something more fun in mind.
Combat training.
Tank pops a mini-disc into what just might be a 130-year-old drive. We can see it loading on one of the screens. The header says, this is Combat Series 10 of 12, and today, kids, we're going to be learning jiu-jitsu.
Jiu-jitsu? I'm going to learn jiu-jitsu.
Not only is he going to learn it, he's going to master it. Tank punches instructions into his keyboard. He then hits load on the touchscreen for the jiu-jitsu training program. Neo's brain is downloading information about jiu-jitsu. It looks about as unpleasant as his jump into the loader program. Neo once again squints his eyes and opens his mouth in a silent scream. Then, it's over. Jiu-jitsu has been installed in Neo's brain.
Holy shit. Hey, Mikey, I think he likes it.
Wow, a serial commercial from 1971 is still a punchline in 2199? That's cool.
About some more? Hell yes.
All right, Neo is into it. We do a slow dissolve, transitioning to a very unique training montage. Instead of watching Neo working out and practicing his new skills, we see the same computer load screen, only it's cycling through all of the martial arts. We actually get to see Kempo, Taekwondo, and Drunken Boxing get installed in Neo's brain. He must be cycling through every known martial art and combat training. Morpheus enters the room and walks up behind Tank as he's still installing software into Neo's cortex.
How was he?
Wow, this montage covered a lot. Tank says he's been going 10 hours straight with these data downloads.
He's a machine.
We pan over to Neo's face. His eyes are twitching under his eyelids like he's having a dream. This is the real-world physical response to a Matrix data download. Neo then looks over at Morpheus and says,
I know Kung Fu.
This statement caused some discussion on the social threads. Kung Fu is not a specific martial art. It does reference the martial arts of China. The general practice of Kung Fu is believed to have originated in China's famed Shaolin Temple. Neo is most likely using Kung Fu with its original meaning. any discipline or skill achieved through hard work and practice. And that's not even necessarily talking about a martial art, although it is most often used to describe martial arts. This is also somewhat humorous because Neo is claiming to have achieved a kung fu level of skill after only 10 hours of sitting in a chair and having data downloaded into his brain. He's never thrown a punch or launched a kick, but he's feeling like he's got this. Practitioners of various martial arts can work and train for years or even decades before achieving what might be considered a level of kung fu. When Morpheus hears Neo claim he knows kung fu, there is only one response.
Show me.
A gong sounds and we dissolve to the inside of a very cool-looking dojo. This dojo set was created early on, and Keanu did get about a month of rehearsal here before he was sidelined with his neck injury. Throughout this scene, if it looks like kicks and other body moves are landing pretty hard, it's because they are. They'd rehearsed this scene extensively, but shoot day was the first time they both had gone full out. They do pull the final punches to simulate a sparring regimen, but the kicks and body hits are all real and very physical. According to Lily Wachowski, at the end of a shoot day in the dojo, quote, "They were covered in bruises and burns from the ropes," unquote. Morpheus and Neo are facing each other in the middle of the dojo floor. Morpheus is wearing a brown gi with beige piping. Neo is in the reverse, a beige gi with dark brown piping along the collar. You will notice the dojo scenes are not tinted green. The dojo has more of a gold aura. This is because the dojo, like the loader program where Morpheus explained the Matrix, is not actually part of the Matrix. They are plugged into a small sparring program that is only running on the ship, and they are the only two logged into it. Morpheus explains the parameters of the sparring program. He stresses it's a program. It has some basic rules, rules like gravity.
What you must learn is that these rules are no different than the rules of a computer system. Some of them can be bent. Others can be broken.
This is why Neo stood out when he was working in the Matrix as a hacker. It's this ability to be able to change code, alter computer instructions, that allows Neo to eventually do what he does inside the Matrix. Here in these training programs is where Neo learns how to control the system.
Understand.
Morpheus challenges Neo to hit him.
If you can.
Neo goes into a crazy cool martial arts stance. Morpheus matches him, extending a foot. We get an impressive wide shot showing the generous dimensions of the dojo. There's plenty of headroom, which is going to become important here in a few minutes. They start out with some hand-to-hand. Neo is getting into this. He's using his newly downloaded fighting knowledge. Don't miss Neo thumbing his nose. The second time he sets, just before attacking Morpheus, you'll see Neo rub the side of his nose with the flat of his thumb. The Wachowskis went nuts when they saw him do this. It's not something they directed. It's something Keanu picked up from watching Bruce Lee fight scenes. Lee did the nose thing as a taunt. Keanu picked it up subconsciously. He said later he didn't even remember doing it. It just happened. Their punches are flurries of motion. Neo then launches himself into a flying triple kick. This was one of the first on-camera kicks Keanu tried after being cleared from his neck recovery. He was not happy with the results. Wo Ping said Keanu's trait in training was persistence, dogged persistence. He was harder on himself than Wo Ping or the Wachowskis ever could have been. Keanu always felt like he was playing catch-up because of his surgery. He'd had less time to practice on the wires. Keanu attempted this triple kick in 21 different takes. This was not at the Wachowskis' direction. It was Reeves pushing himself to do it better. Members of the crew said Keanu would get mad, screaming at himself to get it right. Although multiple takes were declared good, Keanu kept wanting one more shot at it, a chance to make it even better. He was going for the super take. Oftentimes during fight shooting, they would have to convince Keanu what he had done was fine and were moving on. When Morpheus grabs Neo's foot and spins him to the ground, these are both stuntmen. Taking a hard fall like that is the last thing Keanu needed with his neck injury. This particular stunt worked with stunt people because you couldn't really see either performer's face during the spin. If you slow this move down, there are a couple of spots where it's pretty obvious these two are not Keanu or Lawrence. As Neo is laying on the ground, out of breath, Morpheus declares his efforts good. He says he's displaying adaptation and improvisation.
Your weakness is not your technique.
Morpheus seems about to explain the weakness when Neo shuts down the commentary with a kick to Morpheus's head. There's a cut to the inside of the Neb. Mouse, who'd been monitoring the battle, runs to the mess hall.
Morpheus is fighting Neo.
The rest of the crew scrambles to see. Switch even climbs over the dining table. The high jumps and long falls are all thanks to wire work. Each performer is wearing a wire harness that is being operated off camera. As they jump, the operator will increase tension to lift the performer. The wires themselves are removed during post-production. Keanu said when done correctly, the wire work was a lot of fun. If you didn't do it right, he said it could be very painful. Back on the Neb, Neo's body is twitching, reacting in real life to the things he's doing in The Matrix. Dojo Neo is going for it. He runs up a pillar and launches himself backwards a good 10 feet or so off the floor. He flies over Morpheus. Neo lands on his feet, facing Morpheus. This was a pretty impressive move, but there's no time to pause for congratulations. Morpheus springs to the attack. He takes advantage of Neo's momentary recovery at the end of his jump. Morpheus plants a foot in Neo's midsection and causes him to fly across the dojo. Neo hits one of the other wooden upright beams and smashes it into two pieces. Neo winds up face down on the mat, out of breath and frustrated. Morpheus is standing, composed, and breathing normally.
How did I beat you?
Neo says Morpheus was just faster.
Do you believe that my being stronger or faster has anything to do with my muscles in this place?
There is no spoon. There are no muscles. There are only electrical impulses telling your brain the guy across from you is faster. Those impulses are being generated by a computer. Neo is gulping down huge breaths.
You think that's air you're breathing now?
There is no air. There is no dojo. It only seems to exist because of what the computer is telling your mind. Neo contemplates these truths. Morpheus turns his back and walks to the far side of the dojo.
Again.
The entire crew of the Neb is glued to the screens watching the battle. Morpheus takes the fight to Neo, and Neo responds with an amazing flurry of defensive moves.
Jesus Christ, he's fast.
Mouse points to a screen and says Neo's neurokinetics are off the chart. Not sure exactly what they're measuring here, but neurokinetics is a term first coined in the 1970s. It is used in some pseudo-medical communities to address muscle issues throughout the body. Morpheus and Neo move across the floor, fists flying in a blur. Morpheus is taunting him. He says Neo is faster than this. You can see here where thrown punches are being pulled. This is standard for martial arts sparring sessions.
Come on, stop trying to hit me and hit me.
Neo is moving even faster. His hands are a blur. Quick cut to Mouse on the ship. He's loving this. We get a POV over Morpheus's shoulder. Neo's hands are a literal blur. It looks like he has four or five hands on each arm. Then it's Neo's turn to pull a punch. He gets past Morpheus' defenses and is able to bring a fist right to Morpheus's face. Morpheus pulls away, backing his head up against the beam Neo climbed earlier. In the ship, Mouse is stunned.
I don't believe it.
Back in the dojo, Neo says he knows what Morpheus is trying to do.
I'm trying to free your mind, Neo.
This ability is not something that can be handed to Neo. It's something he must find within himself. Morpheus says he can show Neo the door.
You're the one that has to walk through it.
Morpheus then calls to Tank. He thinks Neo is ready to move to the next step in his training.
Load the jump program.
When Tank hits the load button on the touchscreen, we cut to a look at the white void beneath Morpheus and Neo's feet. The scene below changes and we drop into a city from several hundred feet up. They are now standing on the roof of a building. A change of program also means a change of clothes. Can't wear a gi out on the street. Morpheus is once again in his leather duster. Neo is wearing a green t-shirt under a windbreaker. Neo is a bit disoriented by the change of venue. He's trying to get his bearings when Morpheus says,
"You have to let it all go, Neo."
He tells Neo to ignore fear, doubt, and disbelief.
Free your mind.
Morpheus quickly turns and runs to the edge of the building. In just a few steps, he's able to launch himself into the air a good 50 or 60 feet above the edge of the building where he left. He is flying across the space, the tail of his leather duster flapping out behind. He lands hard on the roof of the far building. As soon as he hits, Morpheus turns. He wants Neo to follow. Neo steps to the edge of the roof, where he's standing, and looks down.
Okie dokie.
When Morpheus ordered up the jump program, he literally meant a program designed to train you how to jump. Trinity must have also had this training. We saw her building jumping abilities in the opening scenes. A cut back to the Neb. Mouse is into this like he's watching a WWE cage match.
What if he makes it?
No one's ever made the first jump.
Mouse seems to have bought into the Neo hype. He says, what if he could make it? One of the other Neb crew is certain he won't because nobody does. But even the one? Cut to Neo on the roof. He's backing up, getting ready to run to the edge, just like Morpheus.
Free my mind, no problem, right?
He takes off running and launches himself. It's pretty obvious from the first couple of seconds Neo does not have this figured out just yet. He windmills his arms and starts to free fall. Yeah, I guess even the one is going to have a little trouble with this move first time out. We cut to a shot of the pavement. Neo falls to the street and on into the street. You know how Morpheus said some of the rules of this place could be broken? The street in the jump program looks like it's made out of memory foam mattress material. Neo completely disappears into a deep hole created right in the middle of the lane. The foam street rebounds, shoots him back up into the air a few feet, then lets him land on a harder version of the pavement, just not from so high up. Mouse is crushed. He was counting on Neo to be able to really do this. Switch says it doesn't mean anything.
Everybody falls the first time.
Even the one? Neo and Morpheus are being disconnected from the program. Neo puts his fingers in his mouth and they come out bloody.
I thought it wasn't real.
Your mind makes it real.
Neo then realizes a hard truth about the Matrix. If you're killed inside the construct, you die here in the real world. Although dying in the Matrix means nothing actually happened to your physical body, Morpheus explains the response is only natural.
The body cannot live without the mind.
If your mind thinks you're dead, you're dead. Later, we cut to Neo crashed out in his bunk. The training, although not actually physical, does wear you out. Trinity enters his room with a tray of food. She sets it on the floor next to him. Trinity lingers, looking lovingly at the sleeping Neo. Cypher is waiting in the hall. He has an accusatory look on his face.
I don't remember you ever bringing me dinner.
When it comes to Neo, Cypher is a skeptic, but he says there is something about him, isn't there? He's curious if Morpheus is so sure about this Neo character, why hasn't Morpheus taken him to see the Oracle? At this point, we don't know who or what the Oracle might be. Trinity isn't concerned.
Morpheus will take him when he's ready.
End of conversation. Trinity walks away. Hey, we need to meet this guy. Cypher is being played by Joe Pantoliano. Joseph Peter Pantoliano was born on September 12, 1951 in Hoboken, New Jersey. He started his career in a movie called Road Movie in 1973. In those early days, he performed as Joseph Pantoliano. I first became aware of Joey Pants when he did his hilariously stellar turn as Guido the Killer Pimp alongside new star Tom Cruise in 1983's Risky Business. Joe works a lot. This appearance in The Matrix was just one of 8 appearances he has listed in 1999 alone. Joe is also still working. He has 158 performer credits on his IMDb profile, and 3 of those are upcoming. We also need to talk for a moment about how Morpheus met up with these other crew members. While hunting Matrix threads and pages doing research for the podcast, I came across several discussions about other ones Morpheus may have sought. Someone said, "Can you imagine Morpheus once thought Cypher was the one?" I don't think this interpretation is correct. Some fans believe Morpheus is out trolling the Matrix looking for the Savior, and each of these people he's picked up along the way was, at one time, considered a potential. For some reason, they are now no longer in contention, but have chosen to stick around to work on Morpheus's crew. I just don't think that's what's been happening. Yes, Morpheus has always been searching for the One. I buy that. But I believe he's also been busy assembling a crew. He knew if he were really to eventually find the one, he would need the best operators, navigators, and support people running his ship. They have all impressed him with something about their performance, but I don't believe every member of Morpheus's crew was a failed attempt at finding the one. Neo's training continues. We cut to a street scene. A huge crowd is waiting at a city street corner. They start to cross when the light changes. Morpheus is walking right into the crowd. The stream of humanity flowing our way is separating around Morpheus, not even touching him. Morpheus looks back.
The Matrix is a system, Neo.
We reverse cut to Neo trying to follow. Where Morpheus is practically invisible to these walkers, Neo is getting battered. A guy smacks into his shoulder hard enough to turn him sideways. Morpheus says it is the system that is the enemy. Plugged-in people are also a part of the system. Morpheus explains there is this fine line. These plugged-in people are the same people they're trying to save. The reality is, most of these people are not ready to be unplugged. They want to stay in the Matrix, living their lives without a concern. Yeah, I think I might be one of those.
And many of them are so inert, so hopelessly dependent on the system, that they will fight to protect it.
As he's saying this last, Neo is distracted by a gorgeous blonde in a red dress moving through the crowd. She stands out against the backdrop of drab black suits. She smiles at Neo as she passes. He turns his head.
Are you listening to me, Neo?
Or were you looking at the woman in the red dress?
Neo turns his attention back to Morpheus.
I was...
Look again.
Neo turns to where he'd last seen the blonde. Suddenly, he's looking down the barrel of a Desert Eagle. It's Agent Smith ready to blast Neo with an AE-50 round. Morpheus looks to the sky.
Freeze it.
The woman in the red dress is being played by Australian native Fiona Johnson. I think Fiona had something else going on besides acting, probably modeling. She only shows 6 entries on her IMDb profile throughout the 1990s. She had one additional appearance after The Matrix, an uncredited part in Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones. You might remember Episode II was one of the other movies, which also shot at the Fox Sydney Studios. This scene is not being shot in the studio. They took a little field trip to get this one. They are shooting in the heart of Sydney's business district. This is the circular fountain at Martin Place on Pitt Street. It is an all-pedestrian mall. This area also stood in as a section of Metropolis in Bryan Singer's Superman Returns. When Morpheus says, "Freeze it," the crowd stops completely. Even a bird which was flying past the fountain stops in mid-flight. The water in the fountain freezes. This was a practical effect. The crowd was signaled when to slow, then stop walking. They were supposed to freeze, some in mid-stride. Then a single frozen frame at the point where everyone had stopped was used as the backdrop for Morpheus and Neo's conversation. Neo is just realizing he doesn't have to worry about the agent or the gun pointed at his head.
This isn't the Matrix.
No. It's another training program designed to teach you one thing.
If you'd have given it a second look, Neo, you'd have noticed no green tint. Morpheus says this program is designed to show Neo if he's not one of us, he's one of them, meaning the agents. Neo asks just what they are.
Sentient programs.
Morpheus explains they are code, self-contained subroutines which can move in and out of any software still hardwired into the system. What this means in practical terms is an agent can take over anyone's body anywhere in the Matrix at any time. They project themselves into the code responsible for making you visible inside the Matrix. Once they've inserted themselves into your code, they can take you over, as long as you are still hardwired into the system. Since Neo and the freed crew of the Neb are not hardwired in, they are immune to being taken over by the agents. This ability to move in and out of software still connected to the Matrix is the reason Switch and Trinity were so concerned about having Neo in the car with them the other night. They knew he was still hardwired, and an agent could have appeared in the car with them at any time. Switch wasn't holding a gun on Neo. She was just ready in case he morphed into an agent.
Inside the Matrix, they are everyone, and they are no one.
Morpheus does love to dispense the mystical mumbo-jumbo, doesn't he? Morpheus says the only way his people have survived is by hiding from and running from the agents.
But they are the gatekeepers.
Morpheus says it is inevitable. Sooner or later, someone is going to have to fight the agents if they are ever going to be able to make any real changes to the Matrix. Neo understands what Morpheus is hinting at.
Someone.
Throughout this conversation, do not miss the reflection happening in Morpheus's sunglasses. You can clearly see Neo with Agent Smith's gun pointed at his head. Morpheus doesn't sugarcoat things when it comes to dealing with the agents.
Every single man or woman who has stood their ground, everyone who has fought an agent has died.
Whew! Way to build up Neo's confidence.
But where they have failed, you will succeed.
If you say so, I hope you know what you're talking about. Neo wants to know why. He's getting to it. Morpheus continues to tell Neo scary agent stories. They can punch through concrete. People have emptied entire clips into them and hit nothing but air. Even though they can do these seemingly superhuman things, Morpheus tells Neo the rules of the Matrix still apply even to the agents. They can push what we think of as natural laws to the very edge, but they do still have limits.
Because of that, they will never be as strong or as fast as you can be.
If Neo truly is the one, as Morpheus believes, he has the power to completely remake the Matrix. He doesn't have to follow the rules because he can change the rules in order to meet his needs and defeat the agents. There's something else pretty amazing happening in this scene, which I don't think anyone caught. This is a training program. Whoever wrote it wouldn't want to go to all the trouble of creating unique people to populate this program. To get a crowd like this, a programmer would probably create a few people, then copy and paste them like characters in The Sims. Maybe change what each copy is wearing. This is exactly what they did when casting this scene. It's hard to see, but if you freeze the long shots and look closely at the crowd, you will notice many of these folks look to be repeats. This is not a digital effect. This is happening because the production hired nothing but twins and triplets to appear in this scene. It was a huge casting feat for what doesn't appear to be a huge payoff. Neo is considering Morpheus's words.
What are you trying to tell me? That I can dodge bullets?
Yeah, based on what we see later, that's exactly what he's trying to tell you. Morpheus says, really, it's even more than that.
I'm trying to tell you that when you're ready, you won't have to.
He won't have to dodge him, he'll just make the bullet stop. But he can't know that now. He has to get ready, and that means more training inside the Matrix. It might also mean a visit. Morpheus pauses to answer the 8110. It's Tank.
We got trouble.
As much as we've discussed the impact of the machines on the real world, we've not yet had any interaction with them. We're about to. Cut to an exterior of the Neb. It's racing through a tunnel. Neo and Morpheus have been disconnected from the training sim and returned to the real world. Morpheus takes a spot in the left-hand chair on the bridge. Dozer is his co-pilot. The ship is flying rough. It's banging against the side walls of the tunnel. We don't know yet what the trouble is, but Morpheus looks concerned.
Did Zion send the warning?
Dozer says no, it was another ship that tipped them to whatever we're running from. Trinity has taken her spot at a screen in what would be the navigator's space if this were a jumbo jet. There's a 3D holographic display on the console in front of Morpheus and Dozer. A mechanical-looking squid thing resolves on the 3D display.
Squiddy sweeping in quick.
Neo wants to know, what's a squiddy?
A sentinel. Killing machine designed for one thing.
The sentinel's only job? To search and destroy. Based on the display, it looks like one is close enough to the Neb to be dangerous. The scary sentinels are the creation of illustrator Jeff Darrow. It's this sentinel design that got him the job on the movie. The Neb comes through the end of the tunnel into a larger room. It looks like this might be a man-made open space in the sewers. Morpheus directs them to a landing spot where they should be safe. As the Neb settles into its landing, Morpheus is on the comm.
How are we doing, Tank?
Tank is still seated in his control area wearing his headset. Tank types a few commands into his keyboard, and the power on the Neb fades. It goes completely dark.
Power offline. EMP on.
Neo, standing in the dark of the Neb's bridge, asks Trinity, what's an EMP?
Electromagnetic pulse. Disables any electrical system in the blast radius. It's the only weapon we have against the machines.
An EMP is a brief, broad-spectrum burst of electromagnetic energy. Humans have known about the power of EMPs going all the way back to September of 1859. September 1st and 2nd of that year saw the most intense geomagnetic storm to hit the Earth ever in recorded history. The effects were detailed with extensive notes and drawings by amateur English astronomer Richard Carrington. Because of his detailed reporting, the September 1859 storm is now known as the Carrington Event. It was thought to have been caused by a CME, a coronal mass ejection, coming from the sun. This CME happened to be pointed directly at the Earth, and it was moving faster than most CMEs. Ground-based magnetometers of the era were more than sensitive enough to detail the power of the event. EMPs destroy electronic equipment. Most systems, even if they aren't powered up, are disabled instantly and completely by an EMP. Luckily, in 1859, the only electronics which were affected were the only electronics we had, telegraph stations. Some even reported fires during the Carrington event. Had something like the Carrington event happened in modern day, we'd have seen widespread electrical disruptions, extensive destruction of electronics equipment, blackouts, destruction of our communication systems, and widespread damage to the power grid. Natural occurrences like lightning and electrostatic discharge can also cause a small EMP. This is why it's so important to ground computer equipment. We've also discovered one of the side effects of a nuclear blast is a strong EMP. EMP weapons, like what they seem to have on the Neb, have been designed for use on the battlefield. An EMP generator can wipe out the enemy's communications equipment. It can even disable vehicles, which rely on electronic ignition or electronic fuel injection to operate. This is pretty much any vehicle built after 1980. A branch of electromagnetic compatibility engineering is dedicated to creating electronic systems that can withstand the effects of an EMP. Shutting off the power, like what Tank did, can help a system survive, but the components of the Neb must also have some EMP protections built in. Even though we've powered down, a strong, concentrated EMP blast would still damage unpowered electronic systems. The gang on board the Neb is silent. Neo wants to know where they are. Trinity continues to get Neo and us, as the audience, up to speed about what's happening. Which sounds a little like...
sewers.
Exactly. The upworld cities of the mid-21st century were huge, spanning hundreds of miles. These extensive sewer systems are what's left of the old surface infrastructure. Morpheus is not happy with the whispered chatter on the bridge.
Quiet.
The most frightening jellyfish you've ever seen is swimming in the distance, closing on them. We aren't underwater here in the sewers, but a lot of machine movement makes it look like we are. A closer sentinel appears. It's crawling over the exterior of the Neb. One of its tentacles turns into what looks like a small satellite dish. It's scanning for signs of organic life. After a few seconds, the sentinel decides there's nothing here to worry about and moves on. The gang on the bridge of the Nebuchadnezzar utters a collective sigh of relief. We didn't get to see the EMP in action here, but now we do know it exists. What do you bet we get to see one in the third act? After the emergency has passed, we cut to a long shot of Cypher sitting at the Matrix control area. He has three screens of Matrix code visible directly in front of him. Screens that seem to be monitoring visible areas within the Matrix are to both his left and right. Neo quietly approaches Cypher, maybe a bit too quietly.
Whoa! Neo, you scared the bejesus out of me.
Neo apologizes as Cypher reaches over and casually shuts off all of the monitors to his left. Did Neo catch him doing something he shouldn't have? Cypher says, it's okay. Neo is looking at the screens directly in front of Cypher, the only green we will see anywhere in the real world.
Is that
the Matrix? Yeah.
Neo leans in, watching as the characters cascade down the screen.
Do you always look at it encoded?
Cypher says you have to. The image translators work for the construct, but there is so much underlying information to really see the whole thing, you have to be looking at the code. Cypher says he doesn't even see the code anymore. It sounds like the way a person who has read all their life doesn't see individual letters anymore. They just see words.
All I see is blonde, brunette, redhead.
Cypher is like the kid at summer camp who somehow snuck in cigarettes and a six of beer.
Hey, you, want a drink?
Neo says, sure. Cypher pours something from a jerry can into a tin cup. I doubt it's single malt. Cypher doesn't sound content living here in the real world. He tells Neo he's been thinking about this a lot, and maybe Neo's been thinking the same thing.
Why, oh why, didn't I take the blue pill?
Neo chuckles, but then looks at him to see if he's kidding. Cypher is most definitely not kidding. He slugs down a bit of the hooch directly from the can. Neo has a drink out of the metal cup.
Good shit, huh?
The tension from Cypher's comment dissipates. Cypher has a good laugh at Neo's response to the drink. He says Dozer makes it.
Good for two things. Degreasing engines and killing brain cells.
Oh. Cypher gets serious. He wants to ask Neo something.
Did he tell you why he did it? Why you're here?
He means, did Morpheus tell Neo he's the one, the savior of humanity? Neo nods slightly. Cypher is blown away.
What a mind job.
He wonders what you even say to something like that. He did give Neo a little piece of advice that kind of contradicts what Morpheus was saying. If Neo sees an agent, he should do the same thing everybody else on the ship would do.
Run. You run your ass off.
Neo thanks him for the drink and leaves the control room.
Sweet dreams.
We then get a weirdly disorienting cut. We are looking at a plate. It's fine china. On it is a huge piece of very rare steak. There's a wine glass in the foreground. We're also looking at real silverware on a linen tablecloth. From what little we can see, this appears to be a nice restaurant. The very recognizable voice of Agent Smith can be heard as a bite is being cut.
Do we have a deal, Mr. Reagan?
Reagan? No clue as to what's going on yet. Then the bite of steak is lifted. The camera follows it and we can see Cypher. This is not real-world Cypher from a moment ago. This guy is wearing a sport coat. He's got an earring, a choker, a nice sweater, and the stash and soul patch are neatly trimmed. Cypher pauses to deliver an ode to a piece of meat.
The Matrix is telling my brain that it is juicy and delicious.
He then says, after 9 years of living on the Neb, he doesn't care the Matrix is lying to him. He pops the bite of steak into his mouth.
Ignorance is bliss.
Smith again asks if they have a deal. He is very persistent. He's also probably not thrilled to be hanging around with humans. Cypher agrees with one big caveat.
I don't want to remember nothing. Nothing. You understand?
Playing turncoat and selling out your friends is easy if you have absolutely no memory of doing it. Guilt? What guilt? I didn't do anything. At least anything I can remember. The Matrix will never be confused with a comedy. The yucks are few and far between. But this is one, and it's pretty good. Cypher says he wants to be rich.
Someone important. Like an actor.
Hey, I got a laugh out of it. Smith assures him, whatever he wants. Cypher sums up the deal. He gets put back in the power plant, reinserted in the Matrix, and becomes a rich and important actor. This is all if he can deliver something to Agent Smith.
Access codes to the Zion mainframe.
Cypher says no. He already told them he can't get those codes.
I can get you the man who does.
The Neb is not the only hovercraft out patrolling the sewers. The captain of every craft like the Neb is given the Zion mainframe access codes. If they had those codes, the agents could bring down Zion. He won't give them up easily, but Cypher is saying he can deliver Morpheus with the codes in his head. Getting them out is up to the agents. As we transition into and out of the Matrix more often, you're going to see there is always an operator back on the Neb. They make sure the crew member in the Matrix is safe, and they assist in confirming a hard line to get them back. Several fans have called foul on this scene. How did Cypher get himself jacked into the Matrix to meet with the agents all by himself? According to script notes visible on an extended version of this scene, Cypher figured out a way to rig the system so he could enter the Matrix on his own. This way, he could visit with the agents on the sly while the rest of the group was elsewhere on the ship. Remember how he turned off that bank of screens to his left when Neo walked up behind him, he was probably getting ready to make the jump. He had to hide screens that would have been embarrassing had Neo looked too closely. As Cypher continues to enjoy his juicy and expensive steak, we cut back to the Neb. Tank is at a spigot running something out of a hanging hose. What he's run out is a disgusting-looking metal tin of white, lumpy goo. We are in the Neb's mess hall. Tank puts the tin in front of Neo.
Here you go, buddy. Breakfast of champions.
Is this some kind of hazing for the new guy? Nope, this is what they eat. This might be all they eat. It's a single-celled protein combined with aminos and balanced with vitamins, minerals, and electrolytes.
Everything the buddy needs.
Mouse owns this scene. He won't shut up. He rambles on and on about everything and really about nothing. He's got a bit on Tasty Wheat. Tasty Wheat is a hot cereal, kind of like oatmeal. It's popular in South Africa and it's available throughout Europe. It's made from wheat semolina. Mouse says he used to like Tasty Wheat back when he was in the Matrix, but then he wonders how the machines could possibly know what Tasty Wheat even tastes like. I love his theories about chicken.
You take chicken, for example. Maybe they couldn't figure out what to make chicken taste like, which is why chicken tastes like everything.
I have kind of the reverse theory. I think the machines got chicken right. Once they realized everyone liked it, they made all the fringe stuff just taste like chicken. I tried alligator on a stick at the state fair a few years ago. It tasted, no joke, just like chicken. The thought that immediately went through my head after the first bite, the machines didn't know what to make alligator taste like, so they went with chicken. Mouse is wound up. Mouse's incessant talking doesn't seem like anything new, but he's got a new audience in Neo and he's taking advantage. Apoc tells him to shut up. Mouse quiets for a moment, but he doesn't shut up. It's like he can't. He just changes topics and keeps going. Mouse is monopolizing Neo. He says he heard Neo went through the agent training program.
You know, I wrote that program.
Which means he also created the woman in the red dress.
I designed her.
He's quite proud of her. He says she doesn't talk much, but if Neo would, you know, like to meet her.
The digital pimp, hard at work.
Okay, so Mouse is pretty sleazy. Undeterred, he tells Neo to ignore these hypocrites.
To deny our own impulses is to deny the very thing that makes us human.
Which wouldn't sound quite as bad if he didn't cap it with a sleazy sideways grin. Morpheus enters the mess room. He tells Dozer to bring the ship up to broadcast depth.
We're going in. Taking Neo to see her.
Several important glances are exchanged around the room. Neo turns back to the table after Morpheus leaves.
See who?
It's Tank, who voices what the others are saying with their eyes.
The Oracle.
Got to a close-up of the green digital rain. We pull back to see the Matrix code on three control room monitors. Tank is eagerly saddling up, getting ready to send the gang into the Matrix. It's time to go consult the Oracle about Neo. Although he's never been on a plane in his life, Tank does know the patter from back in the days when humans flew on jets.
Everyone please observe. The fasten seatbelt and no smoking signs have been turned on. Sit back and enjoy.
We cut to an old black rotary dial phone sitting on a table somewhere in the Matrix. It's ringing. Back on the Neb, a spinning overhead shot is showing us the seven crew members who are all entering the Matrix. Only Tank and Dozer aren't connected for this trip because they can't. Before we make the jump into the Matrix, this seems like a good place to pause for today. We are about to meet the Oracle. Cypher is going to reveal he's a turncoat. Morpheus will be captured by agents and Neo is going to realize he truly is the one, but he's going to have to die to do it. We'll get to all of that next time as Severed Origins continues to break down the Matrix. For now, Refiners, it's time to shut things down for the day. If you haven't yet watched, but you want to, you can stream The Matrix on Max, or it's available to rent from all the usual suspects. It's time to get back to your Audi lives. I'll be waiting for you down here on the Severed floor next time. As soon as the elevator door opens, we'll get right back into it. As for Season 2 of Severance, I have faith it's coming, but it will definitely be delayed. The WGA and SAG-AFTRA strikes continue. Surveys say the general public is in support, but writers are hitting some hard times. Stories of writers taking on dog walking and nanny gigs are becoming pretty common. Savings and retirement accounts are being tapped. Word is, some writers and actors might even leave the profession never to return as a result of the strike. Be watching the Severed Facebook page for the latest updates. Until an agreement can be reached, we'll keep things going down here on the Severed floor with more of these origin stories. A housekeeping reminder, make sure to rinse your coffee cups when you put them in the sink. For now, refiners, it's time to exit via the elevator. And remember, as always, please stagger your exits.
You've been listening to Severed, the Ultimate Severance Podcast. Severed is written, produced, and hosted by Alan Stair.
Severed is not endorsed by Red Hour Productions, Endeavor Content, or Apple TV+. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
Severance, the Severance logo, and all video and audio of Severance and Severance characters are registered trademarks of Red Hour, Endeavor Content, Apple TV+, or their respective copyright holders.
Please make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review for Severed at Apple Podcasts.